So Jonathan Ball is a Winnipeg writer. Although, as I just said, he spent 4 years in Calgary doing a PhD, and that's how I know him, because I'm from Calgary. And John is a kind of a Renaissance writer. Not in the sense that he's from the Renaissance, but like in the sense that like he works in a bunch of different modes. So John has, and correct me if I missed something here, John, because I was on the internet trying to like suss all this out today. So John has written 8 books, 2 comic book series.
Well, I mean, I could lose track, Ryan. So
okay.
It depends how you look at it. I'm writing 5 right now, but I don't honestly remember how many are out right
okay.
now. I think but 3 are out.
Yeah. So maybe 3 comic book series. He's done films, short films, although I don't think you've done one in a while. Although I'm not
for a while, no.
And then he runs a podcast as well. And as well, he's been doing a lot of like video game adjacent stuff recently, but we don't need to talk about that.
And I'm bringing the haiku horoscopes back too.
Bringing the haiku horoscope. So if you want to ask him about horoscope writing, among his 8 books, he has 4 books of poetry, starting with Ex Machina, which is a strange kind of like hypertext thing with a lot of footnotes and self-referentiality. Clockfire, which is a collection of plays that cannot be performed. The Politics of Knives, which is a bit more esoteric, but like, how did you put it? It's your book about, Clockfire is your book about theater. Politics of Knives is your book about film.
I call it film and spectatorship and violence.
Okay.
But it's kind of like experimental stories and long poems.
Yeah. And then I didn't pull up all his books, but I do have a few, so I can hold them up to the camera. The National Gallery, which I think John's going to read a bit from in a little bit. The National Gallery, which takes as its conceit like visual art and the gallery, but like is actually a really personal book, I think, especially towards the end. He's written 2 books of fiction. Well, he's written more than 2 books of fiction, but he's published 2 books of fiction. One is a self-published book with the great title, "This Ebook Is Otherwise Provided to You As Is." And then the also great, excellently titled, "The Lightning of Possible Storms," which is this your most recent?
Yes. Yes. If you don't count comics.
Yeah. We'll get to the comics. And then he's done an academic nonfiction book called John Pay's Crime Wave, which is about the Winnipeg postmodern filmmaker John Pays and his lost classic. He's edited with me, and actually I have this on my table because I've got a stack on my table, this book, Why Poetry Sucks, which is a collection of avant-garde poetry that uses humor. That got reviewed in the National Post, and they said the book wasn't very funny, so that's fun. And he's written, I know about 2, but like the one that I actually have here of his comic books, this one, The Eye Collector, which is really beautiful, done with GMB Chomichuk. Is that how you pronounce it?
Chomichuk.
Mm-hmm. And it's like really, really beautiful artwork. Me holding it up to the camera doesn't do it justice. And I think there's 6 issues of that. And you've also worked on some other comic books. I know another one was out, but like I can't remember what it was called.
Yeah, I've got, I guess, now that I look, I've got 3 series out. So one is, so that's a 12-issue series that you're talking about, but only 6 are out, like you say.
Okay.
And then I've got another one called She-Wolf that I just did a first issue for. Yeah. Another one called Dirk Dirksen versus the Demons from Mars. But those are pretty new, and I haven't really done too much to promote them yet at this point.
Okay.
And I got 2 more I'm working on that I haven't announced.
Right on. So there's that. So you can see there's like a wide range of things that John has worked on, which serves us well. He also did a short film. What is it called? Spoonie Bee.
Spoonie Bee versus How Spoonie Bee Got His Hoe Back,
which is very early 2000s title.
Yes, it was a short comedy silent film about a 70s pimp.
Yeah.
So it's done like a stupid silent, like Chaplin-esque film with like this bizarre like blaxploitation style content. It's not a blaxploitation film, but anyway, that ended up actually selling to the Comedy Network. and was screening on the Comedy Network for a while. So every once in a while, like the guy who was played Spinny B would get recognized in bars late at night by drunk people.
Okay. So that's the bio. I'm sure I could say lots of other things about John. I was thinking, as I was writing the bio, I was thinking, I could ask John about like that time his band had their picture in Rolling Stone magazine. So John's done a ton of stuff that I haven't even talked about. So I wanted to kind of break this into four pieces. We'll see, the four pieces might fall apart or fall together as we go. But my general plan, as I talked to John about this earlier, is I want to start by just talking about like what it's like to be a writer, ask some of the kind of really basic questions we've been asking in here all semester. And then I want to talk about revision, and that'll be me prompting John. He's going to do a short reading from his book, The National Gallery. And he's going to talk about the revision process on a suite of poems in there, and how he kind of brought them from maybe the original conception of the poems to them being published in a book. And then after that, I want to talk. We've talked a little bit about the difference between writing privately and writing publicly. I think like once you decide to be like a capital W writer, you have to make the decision to write in public for readers who you don't already know. So I thought we could talk about that a bit. And then at the end, I'm hoping we'll have a bit of time to do a Q&A in case you all have any questions. So
let me piggyback on what you were just saying, Ryan, yeah, as a segue into your first topic, on like being a writer. Because I was thinking about this the other day. It was pointed out to me, something I hadn't really realized, which is that I've been a professional like publishing writer for 25 years now. And
that's a long time.
Yeah, I hadn't realized it, one. But two, I had like, I'm talking from my first like professional publication in CV2 to like now. And I also, the other thing I've done, which I hadn't really thought too much about until it was pointed out to me a little while ago, is that for pretty much the last decade or so of that 25-year career, I've actually made most of my money writing, which is not common, to say the least. And so I hadn't really thought so much about like all the, like when you rattle off like the things I've done.
Yeah.
I think one, it's a long and strange list, like, and you don't see as clear a career path as you might for other people. But two, like one of the reasons for that is because I just was in this thing for like 25 years of like, this is what I'm going to do. And so where you kind of end up, if you're taking it seriously in that way, and if you're kind of moving forward with the goal of this being your main thing.
Yeah.
Is you just sort of end up doing a bunch of different stuff because you have to, frankly, you have to figure out what's going to work. Like you spend like the first, like I spent probably the first 15 years of what I was of my career, just trying to figure out, like just doing different things and figuring out what was going to work.
Okay. Maybe I should ask my first question then. It seems like you're leading me there, which is nice. Thank you.
Yeah. That's what I'm trying to do.
How'd you get started with writing?
So there's sort of two answers to that, but the truest answer in a sense is when I was a kid, I grew up in like the grunge era, you know, like that was when I was in high school or entering high school was in grunge. I think Kurt Cobain died when I was in grade 6, kind of, if I recall correctly. It's like around then. And so I kind of like came of age in the grunge period, and I was really into grunge and metal and a lot of that kind of music. But also like I lived in a real small town of like 100 people in Northern Ontario. And I would wait, like the high school I went to where it collected people from different towns, the whole high school from grade 9 to 13, because we had like a grade 13 then, was 130 people. Like that's how small the place I was grew up it was. So there were no record stores. There's no CD stores, nothing. The only way you could get like a CD was through Columbia House. Mm. And like mail order, basically.
I feel like you need to tell people what Columbia House is.
Well, it's basically mail order CD thing, but they had this great deal where it's like the first 10 CDs like for a penny, and then you have to buy like a bunch on a schedule kind of thing. So yeah, in the end, you pay, you overpay for CDs, but it seems like a great deal. So everyone was like doing Climate House, but anyway, the point being that there was nothing there, and but you're getting like, so you're just getting music from like France, like everyone's taping things off the radio. Well, there's no real radio where I was, but like normally you tape it off the radio, or your friend would go into town, or their cousin would go into Winnipeg and they'd buy a CD while they're in Winnipeg, then they'd bring it home and everyone would tape it. So you end up with all these tapes and things, and you have no like official anything. So what I would do, and also it's grunge and metal that I'm mostly listening to at this point, right? So what I'm doing like is I got really interested in like, well, what are they saying? Because you can't make it out. Like just to listen to it, it's almost impossible to determine what they're saying. So what I would do, because it was tapes, is I'd listen to like songs and I would like keep backing them up and writing down what I thought they were saying. So I basically would come up with my own lyric sheet because I wanted to know what the hell they were talking about. So eventually though, I start getting these CDs in the mail from Columbia House, and they have like the lyrics and everything in them. Like these are real CDs. And so what I would do first off, of course, is I'd order all the, even though I had them on tape, I'd want them on CD. I want to know, like, I'd want like the real album, you know, that Nirvana made or whatever, not just my bad taping from my friend. So what I realized eventually when I got started getting like some of these things that actually had lyrics in them is how wrong I was about the lyrics. Because also this is the age of dial-up internet. So dial-up internet starts coming and you start to be able to look up like things like lyrics online. And so I realized how wrong my lyrics were compared to what they were actually saying, which I know sounds weird to people who didn't grow up in grunge. Like you can kind of have the experience now of listening to the radio and you know what words they're saying, but that wasn't the case. But also I started realizing like some of the things I had written thinking that it was what these people were saying, I actually liked better than the real lyrics. Because what I was doing, thinking, because I was trying to make sense of it. So I would take these, especially for grunge, like a lot of the lyrics are fragmentary and surrealistic and they don't really make sense. It's just like Kurt is saying something that kind of fits here. And he's almost using the words like sound poems. Like there is sort of a sense to some of the things he writes, but a lot of the times what he's doing is he's just using a word that sounds cool there. And so he's kind of doing these sound poems, but I'm like listening to it and trying to make sense of it.
Yeah.
And so I would kind of make it more connective than he would. It was less surrealistic than his were and that kind of thing. And so what I realized is like, I was basically writing these poems without realizing it.
And okay. So
how then I started intentionally writing them, right? Like, so that, then I was like, well, wait a second. If I like what I thought of better than what Eddie Vedder is really saying, maybe I should try writing my own lyrics. So I started writing lyrics. Again, I was getting really into music. So I started thinking about like, let's get a band together. Maybe I'll write lyrics for a band. And eventually that kind of evolved into like, you got notebooks and stacks of notebooks and you're writing poems and coming up with things. And I had always been a reader. I had always had in my head the idea that I loved writing or loved stories and like poems and things. And like, I was kind of like the kid who would read everything that that I could get my hands on. And eventually it just all sort of dovetailed, you know, in that kind of way.
That's what I was going to ask you is like, how do you move from writing these song lyrics to like writing different stuff? Yeah.
It was the same thing when I saw the movie Clerks by Kevin Smith. And if nobody's seen that, it was this indie film that was big around the time that I grew up. And it's basically was made by like a guy who was nobody at the time, like in Minnesota, more or less. Like it wasn't exactly the case, but like he wasn't in Minnesota, but like it kind of boils down.
I think he was in New Jersey.
Yeah, he was. But I think Minnesota because Soul Asylum was connected to that movie. But but the point being that when I watched that movie, I remember distinctly. It's this real like lo-fi indie film. And I remember watching it and rewinding it immediately because of course I'm watching a VHS tape, right? So I got to rewind it and I watched it again. And it wasn't even that I loved the movie that much. It was just that I was like, wow, this is a possible thing to do. And it was kind of like, that's kind of what the lyrics were like for me too. Is like, finally I saw like, oh, these guys aren't doing stuff that's that good. Like I like it a lot, but it's not really as good as I thought it was when I look closely. And so it started to seem like possible to do some of this stuff, you know, like in a way that it doesn't seem possible to write like, you know, a Salman Rushdie novel.
Yeah.
But it seems possible to write like a Nirvana lyric. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it just started to kind of open it up for me a bit. The way that like reading, like where it's like something I really loved, but also it didn't seem that as great or hard to achieve, you know, as I initially had thought it might have been.
Yeah.
So like it was still like they were far away and I was in a small town and like I had no community or there, I didn't know any writers or anything like that.
Yeah.
But so where it kind of developed for me was when I moved to Winnipeg in 98, I moved to Winnipeg and I had already in my head the idea that I was going to be a writer and that's what I wanted to do. But I came here to go to university. And what I immediately started doing was not going to university. Like I enrolled, but I just started going to like any literary event I could go to. Like I would just go to McNally Robinson, like the indie bookstore here. And I would just go see what events were happening. I would just go to those events. Like I would just go try to like figure out what was going on with writers and just meet writers.
Yeah.
And just plug into the community in whatever way I could, you know?
Yeah, that's when I was in my 20s in Calgary, I remember having to do that or not having to do that, wanting to do that. Now it feels like, because I'm old, now it feels like, oh, I have to go to readings. But when you're young right? and you're a writer, it's like you're discovering something for the first time. You're like the millionth person to discover it for the first time. So I remember going to like open mics, things at the different bookstores, just like anything I could find. Yeah,
just anything. And again, just coming from a small town, I was like, wow. I was like, oh, geez, you can go meet a writer, you know, like, you know, like I just never occurred to me that you could meet a writer before.
Yeah. What genre did you find you were kind of drawn to first? What was the easiest to break into?
As a writer or just what I was interested in?
Either.
As a writer, I started out as thinking I was going to be a musician, even though I couldn't play any instruments. Like thinking I was going to sing in a band and be a lyricist. Like that's where I kind of started. And again, I was playing in band stuff, but like my first published writings were song lyrics. Cause I had gone to I was dating a girl who was really interested in spoken word poetry. So I took her to like this spoken word poetry night going on in Winnipeg. And I met Clarice Foster, who was running CB2 magazine. It was like this night where they were kind of devoted to, anyway, I'd gone on stage just because I was at an open mic and I was like, oh, I'll go on stage. And I just read, you know, some random things I had written. I had all my notebooks, you know. And I remember like talking to her. She had said something nice to me afterwards and she like invited me to submit to her magazine. And I end up, because they were doing a special issue on like music or something, music and poetry. So I ended up basically like sending her like these song lyrics because I was writing a lot of non-rhyming song lyrics at the time for whatever reason. I can't remember why, but I was really enamored with Tool and Maynard James Keenan's lyricism.
I was going to say, it sounds like a metal thing to do.
It was very, it's a very metal thing, right? So I was writing like these very like Tool-like lyrics and I was kind of in a Tool-like band at the time. And so I submitted these to CB2 and because they didn't rhyme, they didn't really have like a song structure, but they kind of did. Like they kind of had the meter, but not the... Anyway, they just seem more like poems. So anyway, she accepted them for CB2. And so that was sort of my first real publication. And she paid me for them. And it was just kind of like, I was already interested in writing. But then like, what I saw immediately was, this is so much easier than working with other people in a band. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Especially when you don't write music. It's like, you're at the behest of these guys, you know? And I really liked the idea that in addition to already being interested in writing, I really liked the idea that I could just do it myself and I didn't have to depend on somebody else to do it. Like that was always my thing. So even when I've gone into comics or film or whatever, like I always kind of come back to like what I like having at the core of what I do is a thing that I can do myself. And if everything else goes away, this is sort of the thing, like what I liked about writing and where I always saw it as somehow better than having a job was that I couldn't be fired from it. Like nobody could stop me from doing it. And that was sort of the thing that was always in my head was like, the only person who can really stop me is myself. Everything else, somebody has a control over me or a possible control over me. And so I'm a control freak in a certain sense, you know, like I'm a bit of a perfectionist and a bit of a control freak. And I like to work with other people and I've gotten more interested in that. But what I like fundamentally is the idea that I'm in charge on a certain level.
Okay.
Although you kind of lose some of that control when you move into the world, but
yeah,
it does kind of come back to you fundamentally. Like maybe you can't get everything you want published by someone else.
Yeah.
You can always publish it yourself these days. And you could always like, there's always some way that like you're in control on a certain level, yeah, whether you like it or not.
So I think that makes me want to ask, because we've talked a lot in this class about things like schedules and tools. So if you're kind of controlling, if you want to think like Marx, like Karl Marx, if you're controlling the means of production for yourself, mm-hmm, what does that look like for you? Like, what are the tools you use? What does your schedule look like? That's kind of a big question, but.
Well, yeah, it's looked differently at different times, you know, like, so like nowadays, I'm technically a corporation, you know, like I've got two part-time employees. I know I'm sitting in a studio here that I'm renting this space in the studio, and I'm doing my, you know, taxes right now because my tax deadline is later than the normal tax deadline. And like, it's very complicated is the short story. Like right now it's gotten real complicated, although I'm not like crazy huge or complex, but still, even like at my, you know, smaller level, like I'm kind of in that mid-range, right, where it's more complicated probably than it needs to be.
Yeah.
But it is like, so with that sort of, with where I'm at, like, so one, there's a lot of it's a lot, and plus I've got small kids, so one, it's a lot more chaotic, and there's a lot more moving parts than there once, yeah, was, like when it was just me and it was just, I was, you know, not really worrying about other people in the same.
Yeah. Cause I remember when you were in Calgary, I remember talking to you about it, and you're like, I wake up at 6 a.m. every day and I write for 2 or 3 hours. And then I have the rest of the day to do whatever. And I'm like, oh
yeah. Man, so now it's a bit together. Now I try to do that, but I can't anymore. So like, but it's very similar when I'm doing a good job. So there's sort of like when I'm doing a good job, when I'm doing a bad job. When I'm doing a good job is I'm kind of like, I really believe in the model that you have to, just like, you know, in your personal finances, in personal finances, what they say is you have to pay yourself first. So if you get $100, you know, you take, you know, $15 and you put it in an investment before you pay your bills. Like that's actually, it sounds counterintuitive, but that's like proper money management is, mm-hmm, if you have a bill due, you don't pay it. And instead you pay yourself. And then later on, everyone else gets what's left over. And of course, you know, it gets more complicated than that at a certain point, but the simplicity of that is still true. Like if I'm doing a good job being a writer, what happens is once my workday begins, so one, I start as soon as I can, rather than playing a Zelda. But two, once that day begins, the discipline that I have to force upon myself is that I do my own thing first. And I kind of hide out from other people as much as possible until I've gotten my writing in, basically. And yep, then like, so I have a kind of a minimum amount of writing that I do in a day, on a good kind of thing. And then later on, I'm oscillating between different things to advance different projects. And then ideally I'll come back and do some more of my own writing. Like, and when I say my own writing, what I mean is like, I do a lot of writing in a day, but I kind of differentiate in my head between like the writing I'm doing for like my thing that I own, that I do, and the writing I might do for a client or something. You know, or like writing I might, you know, do for someone else. So if I'm like editing a manuscript, or if I'm writing like an article for, I don't really do articles anymore, but I used to do like book reviews, for example, for the Free Press. So like, I would kind of differentiate in my head, like before I do the book review that's going to pay me money, I've got to first like write words on my poetry book where, you know, maybe I'll make no money, but like that's, to me, that's the important job. The important job is writing the poem that I'll never get paid for. And the less important job is making money for writing something for someone else.
Yeah.
And it sounds weird to say it that way, but that's honestly, not only do I believe that that's artistically the best way to do things, but I also, if you really get down to the brass tacks of how business works, and fundamentally, like what I am is a business. The way that business works is you either buy assets or you build assets. And what I'm doing is building assets. You always have to be building your own assets and be focused on asset construction and asset acquisition before you get into like making money. Making money is not as important as building a machine that will make you money in the future. And although that's not really what I'm doing on some level, there is like a technical way that's what I'm doing. And like the discipline of it is that you have to kind of, like if you're running a company or if you're trying to make a career of it, you sort of both have to, in both cases, you have to be in the discipline of deferring your gratification. So like when I, like in the company thing, like I end up probably making the least amount of money of everybody. Like I there are months where I make less money than my part-time employees, because the important thing is not to make money.
Yeah.
The important thing is just to get stuff done and get projects completed. So yeah, cause, and that's how I am going to make money. Like, don't get me wrong. Yeah. I'm making some money here, but
yeah,
you kind of have this weird way you have to reconstruct your life. I what I say is I live like a vampire, where it's, I'm kind of doing the opposite of what everyone else is doing.
Yeah.
You know, like a normal job, you'll go to work and you work for an hour, they pay you for the hour. And in a normal job where you're working an hourly wage, the problem is twofold. Like one, you can't create more hours. You can only sell the hours that you have. You can't manufacture more hours.
Yeah.
But two, the better you get the job, the worse that you get paid. Because the more you get done in an hour, the better you get at your job. You're just creating more money for somebody else.
Yeah.
But you're not getting any more money necessarily, like unless you have some weird commission structure or something. But I'm like the reverse. It's like where I make the most money is like if I don't work. Like if I like my ideal scenario is I charge you money and I do as little as possible and work, do my own thing.
Yeah.
And spend your money. So, I mean, it's easier said than done, but like you kind of are in this weird vampire scenario. It's like when I'm doing the best is when I'm not making any money, but like getting ready to do, like getting things done that are going to kind of work for me in the future, you know, but it's still, you know, you got to eat food. So it becomes complicated to balance all those things. And I find that I spend a lot of my day just kind of negotiating psychically how I'm going to get through this day on a certain level.
You know? How do you balance the unpaid work that's more important to you and the paid work that like will suck up all your time if you let
because it. The trap of it is that you get paid money. Like it sounds weird, but like the trap is somebody pays you money, so you do things to get their money. But that's a trap.
Yeah.
And it, like it, early on, it's like you're so obsessed with trying to make some money. At the later stage of your career, it kind of becomes about, okay, I got to obsess about not making money. And like I once like and just really prioritizing that schedule.
Yeah.
Because it gets harder to have a consistent schedule. Like every day I do the same thing. So what I've found is like kind of have moved into like a weekly thing. Like every week I've got like these pockets that I'm going to work and write in. Maybe I have to shift them around. But if so, like I do shift them around. I don't just skip them, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of so like discipline of it is that kind of thing where like you're sort of you know, forcing yourself to do something that may or may not pay off later, but is more important than the thing that will immediately pay off.
Well, let's pivot hard and I want you to talk about something that probably didn't make you any money. I was hoping you could read a bit from the National Gallery. You were saying you're going to read these.
Well, you had asked about revision. And so I thought this was an interesting poem to look at in the National Gallery. There's just a bunch of these long poems and some shorter ones too. But there's this poem called The iPhone Elegies. And I thought this is a good example of both kind of how I came up with the poem, I think is a useful lesson for writers about process. And then also the kind of path of editing. It kind of opens you into like the editing path a little bit. So I'm just going to read this. It's a lengthier poem. It's called The iPhone Elegies. And if people don't realize it, so the National Gallery is a book of poems that in many ways, as Ryan noted, is about visual art, you know, gallery art. But on a kind of deeper level, what it is about is, I was thinking a lot about art and just what is art. And this is because I was doing a PhD, before this, and thinking and going through all these readings on like what is art, and I'd become really enamored of this idea from Shklovsky that like art is technique, that art involves this defamiliarization, this idea that we're going to use art to connect ourselves to the world. We've gotten so far away from the world that we just take it for granted.
Yeah, we're going to make the stone stony.
Exactly. Art's supposed to make the stone stony or shock you into like this recognition of the familiar that you normally pass by. It's going to make the familiar strange to you. And therefore, paradoxically and ironically, art is going to connect you to the world. But art is therefore this mediating force that's between you and the world, but it's also paradoxically connecting you to the world. So I was really interested in that tension, because for me, where a poem starts is just coming up with an interesting tension. Just like a story for me is all about conflict, like plot conflict and other types of conflict. To me, a poem is all about this kind of idea conflict and this, you know, thematic or, you know, some other tension. So I was thinking about that, but also as I was writing this book, which, so all these different parts of this book is like poems about this, poems about that, but they're all like about art as a mediator. Because there's that tension to me again, like on one level, it's connecting us. On the other hand, it's disconnecting us from the world. So there's like a positive and a negative possibilities for all that. But then I also started thinking about how do we mediate our own relationship with art? And I was thinking about technology and the experience of taking a picture of on your phone. Like you go to the gallery and you want to like take a picture of the art. And I was either doing that or thinking about that one day. And I thought like, well, now I got the phone in here as this additional mediator. Like we use the phone to mediate to other people these days. And again, there's good and bad about that, right? On one hand, it's disconnecting us from other people because we're in our phones. On the other hand, it's kind of letting me talk to Ryan, you know, where maybe I might not have been able to because he moved away kind of thing. And so there's like this connection and disconnection to the mediation of the phone. But then also like once you add art in there, it's like now you're standing in front of the Mona Lisa, and instead of looking at it, you're taking a picture of it with your phone so you can talk about that picture later or put it on Instagram or whatever, right?
Yeah.
So just like thinking about all these.
Yeah, like going to a, like I think like going to a concert, and instead of watching the concert, taking a video of the concert. Like that's,
yeah, which I mean, yes, I think it was at a concert thinking about this exact thing. Like, so anyways, this was sort of in my head, and I was reading Rilke. As I teach the Rilke poem, Archaic Tourist of Apollo, a lot, because I consider it to have this great volta, like one of the best endings in any poem. So it made me kind of reread Rilke, who was one of the poets that I originally, when I was a kid, I really got interested in Rilke. And I was really interested in the Duino elegies. So these famous poems that Rilke supposedly wrote, he was basically given a castle to hang out in. And then he like was there and he's writing these poems. It was Duino Castle, and it became known as the Duino elegies, these beautiful like poems that he wrote. So I was rereading that. I was doing kind of research into that, and I was sort of thinking about these ideas. And like, to me, like, all the best writing takes place at the kind of nexus of reading, where you're kind of just getting inspired or stealing ideas from things, research, where you're actually like going out and trying to learn things about a topic, and just randomness, like just random connections are coming between things. So it started to happen as I was filling out the National Gallery. I was trying to like come up with another sequence of poems to fit in the book and kind of fill it out, you know? And I was thinking about this, and I thought, well, why don't I write my own Duino elegies, but I'll call it the iPhone elegies. And it'll all be like about my phone. Like these, I'll kind of like do, instead of writing about the heavens and angels and the cosmic universe and spirituality, like Rilke is doing, I'll write instead about the phone that I use, because I'm an atheist. So like, I don't have this spiritual connection, but I do have like this phone that I use, which is almost in a weird way as close as I can get. Like the algorithm is as close as I get to God in a certain level. Like the algorithm is curating my experience. It's designed a world for me, like on a certain level, you know?
Yeah.
And there's a dangerous side of this, but there's also like this, you know, blessed path that the phone will take you on, you know, and this way it integrates into your life. And so anyways, I thought also I just like the joke of it, like the joke of like, why not just take this classic set of beautiful poems,
yeah,
and kind of pervert them on a certain level, bring them down to earth, right? And then at the same time, I thought to myself, like, could I do that and preserve the kind of beauty and awe of them at the same time? Like, could you write about your phone, but also be like seriously writing about something in the way that Rilke was doing, this heightened manner? And then also I just thought I was kind of stuck a little bit. And I was, anytime I'm stuck in my writing, what I like to do is just pick some other object and write about it.
Yeah.
So like I've done this in other books where it's like, I'll watch a movie and just start writing about the movie, you know? So in this, I was like, what's great about the Duino elegy? Once I hit on this idea, I thought, well, what's great about this is anytime I'm stuck, I can just look at the Duino elegies and pull out a line I like and just steal that line. And like, I can put it in the poem and people will, one, they'll recognize it as Rilke's line. One, so I can put in the acknowledgements, like, you know, these lines were taken from Rilke. I can italicize ones where I've taken them wholesale. Other ones I can rewrite myself. People will recognize what I'm doing. Like the audience that knows Rilke and knows these famous poems will see what I'm doing. So it's not like I'm plagiarizing Rilke. I'm like casting like an allusions to him in this really deep fashion.
Yeah.
But also like, it just kind of gets me lifted up from being stuck. And I can just like start with a line from Rilke and just complete it. So that's sort of how the poem begins. So I'll read the sequence, but like, I just want to note that the first line here is this very famous opening line with Duino elegies, but I've just added a couple words to it. So the first very famous line of the Duino elegies is, "Who, if I call out, will hear me among the angels?" And so here's my sequence that begins with that, and then every once in a while you'll hear like a famous, if you know the poem, you'll hear some lines from Rilke in here, but I'll read the sequence.
It's okay if you don't,
I mean, I assume because people don't know.
I don't know Rilke, so like
basically anytime it sounds super great it's probably a Rilke line. So anyway, so here I'm just gonna read the poem. It'll take me a couple minutes to just run through it all here because there's a few, it's like 10 short poems in a sequence. So again, this is the iPhone elegies. "Who, if I call out, will hear me among the angels that decline all calls? And even if I text, words will not reveal my mind, only corrode my heart. My phone flattens my feelings and sends them away where they rise up in misshapen forms, water distorted, like fathers fallen into streams. I walk in night, dead writer of this dark poem, filled up with stolen words. I cannot make them do what I want. I cannot make you hear what I say. We hear only our own echoes, words of others in our voice, all the unsaid, unmeant, in the shadow inside our skulls. Voices transformed into pings, bells, tiny bird songs. Not that I can endure voices anymore, far from this. Without headphones, it is strange to inhabit Earth, strange to hear those deadly souls pass on the street, crunching snow. Strange for meaning to cluster still in small, small hands. And being dead is hard work, so we give up on death. Anxiety on fleek. Phones back ourselves up into clouds, lift us to cold heavens like we knew they would. Snow falls despite our settings. Snow keeps falling down, no matter what we want. I am the young man in love with an older lament. I name the constellations, the daughter, dark mother, this son. I'm in an abusive relationship with poetry. My phone likes this with a little heart. Half the world is sad little hearts now. So many hearts flit through our days. What do I love when my phone is off? When I silence all the world with one sharp tap? Do the black mirrors we dissolve into taste of us? They have consumed us in the overwhelming night, which we need their light to endure, but even so weak, it annihilates us. We turn to them in our need, but their stars shine only when they want to sell us things. We're not really at home in the algorithm's world. Our phones are best lovers. They know what we want, what we need, and what we will admit. Their bright screens bleed us to soft sleep. Their dark screens reflect the dead stars. Every update, new emotions, new icons to send. Dream the update that will take my choice away, that will carve off all my options. The ideal phone, the one that exploded, that knew what the world wanted. Turn it on for one last option. Hold it close. Take your terrible chance. My phone tells me when you like me, when you like what I have shared. My phone holds all that I don't share. Myself stands headless, my selfie the statue now. Then streets call and I walk to think, but I don't think in poems anymore. The night sharpens itself against me, strives to cut what remains of my skin. Oh stars, I see you from my city, this dark city dimmer than you, small shy stars. My phone inside my heart's pocket, walking with me, counting footfalls, tracing on its secret maps my silent steps. Predict my speech to text to ancient terrors. Catch me in the spreading waves of now gone lakes. This field whose snowy face I scar was once a lake bed, where primal fish shimmered in lunar light. Now hands grasp photos of a dimmer moon. Beneath streetlights, my shadow joins me. Between streetlights, my shadow is free. IRL, my shadow hates me. IRL, nothing photographs well. Atrocity smiles for my photos. How can I help loving what smiles at me and offers up its fake flesh for my feed? Rilke only wrote 2 elegies at Duino Castle. Later grand, hashtag littergrammed the rest. The nearest moment so far from us, always, he said. Always, we pull away from what we see, from what sees us. Dead children reach for us, we flee. Rilke without iPhone, but still prophet of our age. Murderers are easy to understand, he wrote. Who can endure these half-filled human masks? Better Leatherface, whose mask masks nothing. At least it is full. We only dream of existing. How we squander our hours of pain, writing poems, hiding from the world, the darkness of the depthless page. It takes more than one life to become who we are, but we have only just one life to sharpen bladed souls. In my city of snow, of wind, of ice, of terror, in my city of veins, of crows, of lakebed clay, I walk without knowing where I'm going, walk forever beside who I think I am. My children follow and my damaged footprints break snow and blur my once perfect trail. Once I wrote of wolves, of the holes their notes would carve out of the sky. Now I write of the throat that I offer to whatever teeth willing to try. Our cameras turn to the kill, turn to us, and we live stream our own deaths, timelines, becoming traps. Oh, to be disconnected by a pure event. Oh, to be dead at last and know them endlessly, all the stars. So, just to thank you, Ryan, and everyone, but just to sort of note just a little bit of where my head was at with a poem like that. Like, what I really like is the idea of setting a set of coordinates for myself. So, like, I grew up, my creative writing class that was really influential on me was one run by this poet, Dennis Cooley, out of Winnipeg. And Cooley taught me this idea. I assume he got from somewhere else, but I loved the way he phrased it. He liked the idea of, like, you kind of pick a site, like a thing that you want to investigate, like an area, you know, and you kind of metaphorically, you kind of figure out where the boundaries are, like, this is the site I'm going to explore. And then you just start mining the site. And the way he put it was just kind of like, see what's there, you know, just kind of like, so if I'm thinking like, okay, I got the idea of mediation. I got the idea of, you know, this poem as a this phone as a mediator that syncs up with the poem as a mediator. Right. You know, this poem is how I'm experiencing. I'm going to think about the poem, the phone through my poem. And I'm going to think about my life and how I use the phone in my life. Yeah. I'm going to think about. So then it just starts to click into like, well, what clicks into place there? I've got, you know, this Rilke poem as the base. I can take lines from that thematically connect, that just I like, or that kind of connect to this idea of mediation. And I can pick also just ways I use a phone. It's like, what do people do? Well, I saw this tweet this other poet had put and I had liked it. And I thought, well, what if I write a line, I take their tweet and put it in my poem. And then I also put how I liked it in the poem. And I talk about the hearts. Once you got a heart, it's like, well, what else, you know, how do hearts work in poetry? You know, you've got, what else do I use? Well, I take photos of my phone. I try to take photos of the moon. Photos of the moon never turn out, right? You know, there's all these like things that are just sort of there that are shared experiences. Like we all kind of, so the key to me always is like, what is something that the reader and myself share, but aren't thinking about, And then if I could just find some new, again, just the classic defamiliarization. So like once I had the idea, for example, of Instagram, I was thinking about Instagram and like how you take pictures, you post them on Instagram. And the normative way that people use Instagram then is to like take photos of their life and put it up on Instagram. And you kind of like have the idea that your Instagram feed is sort of these snapshots from your life. But if you reverse the idea, like then another way to kind of reframe your Instagram feed is it's not just these like moments in your life, it's you live streaming your death, right? Because as you're sort of, you know, everything you're putting on is like this sort of moments, like as you march towards your death. Like if you just sort of reframe it and you just kind of reverse the coordinates a little bit, you start to get into these interesting areas and you kind of start to see like how these things are connecting or disconnecting. To me, that's a really fruitful space because then I can just start doing research to fill in that space. Like I can look into like, I was really interested in I was doing a lot of walking because it was snowing and I was walking through all this deep snow because in Winnipeg, they never plow the streets. They run out of their plow budget really fast because there's snow so much here. And so you end up having to walk through all these like deep snow drifts all the time. And what I was doing was like, as I was walking through these deep snow drifts to get to the bus or whatever, I just was kind of like, I would kind of write in my head, like, what are lines? And I was finding it harder and harder to do it. And then I was thinking a lot about walking. And there's just were all these ways in which I was like, I just started thinking about that. You know, I was like, well, I got the snow here. If all the snow melted, it would be water. Winnipeg is actually in a lake basin, like it used to prehistorically be a lake here. So there's just these ways, anytime I can connect two things, you know, it would be, that's sort of what I would try to do because it gives you something to do. Like, and a lot of it ends up being garbage. So you talk about revision, what I end up doing when I'm using that process is I end up having to revise a lot because you basically end up overwriting and then having to strip it down.
Yeah. Well, my next question was going to be like, so you go through this process of doing all this research and connecting all these things and doing almost like, and I always call it when I talk about this with students, like an accordion edit where you write too much and then you pare it back. Like, and you do that a few times, or I do it a few times when I do that kind of stuff. But then when you get to the point where you've convinced a press to publish a book of this, what does revision look like at that point, at that kind of late stage?
When you like, I mean, you're getting feedback from the press's editor, is that what you mean? Yeah. So, I mean, I'm a bit of a weird writer, I guess, in that way where I don't get usually there's a couple exceptions, but often I don't get a ton of, substantive edits from a publisher because usually by the time I've sent it off, it's pretty polished. I get a lot of like line edits, I find. So actually, I shouldn't say that. There was one really substantive edit that I got in here where, Susan Holbrook was my editor on this book for the press. So I edited in two ways, I should say. Actually, there was two big editing processes I went through. So before I took it to the publisher, I had, so a lot of this book is, you know, also about just my kids. And I've got like two small kids who like, you know, right now they're, you know, 6 and 8. By the time I wrote this book, you know, they're really young. And then I've also got this older daughter who's 23 now. But at the time I wrote this book, she was around 15, 16. So one of the things that was sort of happening in this book was, so one, I had a bunch of poems about her in the book, in the draft. But two, she's in this teen year scenario. And like one of the things that you happens with kids in the teen years is they kind of are in this position where on one hand, they want to spend a lot of time with you, but on the other hand, they don't want to spend a lot of time with you. You know, like they kind of hate the idea that they want to spend time with you. So you kind of have to almost engineer these ways they can spend time with you in a low pressure fashion. Like they can spend time with you, but they don't have to talk. You know what I mean? So I would kind of like have these scenarios. So what I wanted to did at a certain point, because she was interested in writing too, is I printed all these poems out and I kind of just told her like I was making her like an unofficial editor on the book. And what I just wanted her to do was to go through this pile of poems because I was trying to whittle it down. Like I had like, you know, hundreds of pages of poetry. And I just basically, I gave her a pile of poems. I just made her grade it. I give them like an A, B, C kind of like.
Or like piles or something.
Yeah. I had her kind of, if I remember right, the process was I had her put an X on the poems that she thought shouldn't be in this book, a check mark on poems she was sure this should be in this book, and a circle on poems where she didn't know about it. And so one, this is a way, and I told her I don't want any notes on them unless at this stage. So one, that was a way for her to be able to X without having to say why any poem that was about her that she didn't want public. So she could just put an X on it and didn't have to say why. But two, it gave me that kind of instant feedback from like a reader of like what's grabbing them.
Yeah.
And I find that's often just more useful than real note line feedback. Like, I like this, I don't like this. It's just what's the gut reaction. And so once I kind of had whittled out the poem she hated for some reason, and also they basically ended up being the ones I also thought were not that great anyways. Then I had all these ones that she thought were really great. So I looked at that pile again, and like some of them, I mean, I still got rid of some of them, but a lot of them I thought were kind of worked, and I also liked them, and I was going to keep them in some form. Then I had all these kind of maybes from her. So again, I kind of whittled out the ones I thought were best and then got rid of some of the ones so eventually I had this like manuscript pile, but it's not organized. So then I start to go through it and organize it. And, you know, I kind of restructured the book. Fast forward to, so I did a lot of back and forth, kind of just getting her feedback and like showing her versions of things. And I tried different poems. Like, she had a lot of, she didn't like the poem I put in the front. So I like changed what poem it was to be at the front, and so on and so forth. Like, so I just started like putting a manuscript together. So it was pretty polished and pretty clean by the time I went to the press. And then when they accepted it and they gave me a kind of official editor, what she did was she more or less went through and like gave me minor notes about like how to make this poem better or that poem better. But there was one section where she's like, this section is garbage or doesn't work. She had a couple of things like that where she's like, this section is great in and of itself, but it doesn't work in the book. And of course, what this section she flagged was a section I had written for The Politics of Knives, but then it had gotten kicked out of the manuscript at a certain point. And I was trying to force it back in because I really liked this sequence I'd written, but it just doesn't fit in the book. So I had tried to force it into the book. So there's just no revising that. Like, she had all these notes on it, like maybe it could be this, maybe it could be that. But I kind of recognized like, she's not saying it, but she should be saying I should just kick it out of the book.
Yeah.
She's being too polite. But she's isolating, like it's not working. And I don't know why. So I ended up just removing that. Like, I find a lot of, like, to you say the accordion thing, like a lot of my editing process is just going through and just eliminating things. And I just won't even bother to revise them often. I'll just, my first revision is, can I just delete the thing entirely? And my second revision is, okay, if I don't want to delete the thing entirely, can I delete most of it? Like, I'll just delete, like, I just delete everything if I can, you know? And like, often what I'll find is if I'm trying to revise a line, first I'll just delete it and just see what happens if I delete it. And almost 90% of the time, it's better to delete the line than revise it.
Yeah.
At least from my style, which is a minimalist style. So I'll often just whittle down that way. And so by the time I've got a manuscript that I think is in decent shape, usually the tweaks that happen after I've deleted everything down to its essence are relatively minor and probably only like things I would care about. But the core revision in my head is working from this kind of macro of like, what are the big, like what poem should be in this book?
Yeah.
What section should I have? What order should the sections be in? Then I start thinking about like inside of each section, what poem should there be? What order should they be in? Inside of each poem, how many stanzas should it be? What order should they be in? Like inside of that, how many lines? Like I just really go from big to small. And as I'm going from like big to small, I'm asking the same question always, which is, what is this thing in its core? And can I just simplify it down to its core essence?
Yeah.
And the abstract the kind of practical way I do it is I think from like big to small. Like if I can just get rid of that stanza, I'll just get rid of it.
Yeah.
Rather than trying to reorganize it. But if I can't get rid of it, like if it is essential, then the question becomes, well, how much of it can I get rid of? Like what is essential?
Yeah.
And then that's just like, so the practical side of it is kind of married to the more abstract side of it. The more abstract side of it is, once, if I'm clear on what this thing is, I need to, so one, I just need to get clear on what this thing is, like what is this poem or what is this story? What is its core and its heart? And can I just strip everything down so that once I'm clear on what it is, the challenge is, can I make it more of what it is and less of what it is not? And either I'm adding things to make it more of what it is, or I'm eliminating things to make it less of what it's not. You know what I mean? No, and that sounds abstract, but there is like a practical side of how you do that.
It makes sense. And the real problem, I find this too, the real problem with like that is like, in order to figure out what it is, to figure out what the kind of core of the poem or the story or whatever piece you're working on is, sometimes you have to write a lot to even answer that question. And that's why you were sitting with like hundreds of pages.
Or get responses from people. And like, what are like, so I'll give you a concrete example though of it.
Yeah.
Like, so let's say I write a lot of horror and comedy. So I don't exclusively do that, but often I'm working like horror and comedy, right? So like, those are the two where it's easiest. Like if you're writing a comedy, if it's funny, keep it. If it's not funny, take it out. Like that's basically where it boils down to me. It's like, if I'm writing a horror, it becomes like, okay, if it's scary, it stays. If it's not scary, it goes. Like that's like, when in doubt, like you're just stripping out everything that's not scary. Or anything that's not a joke, you know, or whatever. Like, so it's simpler in horror and comedy because you get that reaction and you can even just test the reaction. Like if you're, you know, working in a comedy club, which I don't really do, but if I was that's how comics work, right? They'll go to a comedy club, they'll tell a bunch of jokes. And then what do people laugh at? Well, those jokes stay and the jokes that they don't laugh at go. This is why comedians hate people recording their shows, because often those jokes aren't done. So they don't even think it's funny.
Yeah.
They're just saying it to see if it's funny. Mm. And so I think there's a level at which you kind of, at a certain point, this maybe connects to your public stuff, but there's a certain point where you need to kind of invite the audience into this to get a feedback loop going.
Yeah.
Not because what they think matters so much, but because you need to sort of see how they're reacting to things to sort of see if they belong.
Yeah.
Like I often am trying to upset the audience rather than give them something they like.
Yeah.
But I still need to know, like, is it just in my head that this thing is funny? Or is it just in my head this thing's scary? Or is it just in my head that this thing is like, is just me that finds it interesting? Or is there actually something here? You know, I don't know at a certain point. Because you just are looking at it too much, and it's like saying a word too many times, you know, after a while.
Yeah.
It starts to mean nothing and you can't have perspective on it anymore.
No, that makes total sense.
At that point, like, it helps to really get that public. I mean, I really believe in as early as possible, you get things in front of people and you get their reactions to it. And you kind of, one, you have to learn to emotionally uninvest in their not invest in their reactions.
Yeah.
And not be offended if they're upset, or not be like happy if they like it. You know, you have to kind of just sort of divorce yourself a little bit from your emotional investment in the work in order to like serve it better in a certain way.
Yeah. Cause if you're delivering, say, a comedy routine and only a quarter of the joke,
you can't be laughing, right?
Yeah. Cause that, you're, if you're precious,
if you're laughing, they don't think it's funny.
Yeah. If you're precious about all those like jokes that weren't funny, you're going to want to tell those jokes again and you're going to bomb.
And maybe there's something there. Like maybe you just haven't found the phrasing.
Yeah.
And so it's like comedians will do that. Right. And the same is true for like a writer of poetry or fiction. I mean, in my book, Lightning Possible Storms, there's a story called Explosions in this book that took me forever to write. And I should have, by all rights, I should have stopped writing it and just abandoned it. Right. But I just knew there was something there and I just wasn't getting it to work. So I just kept struggling to get it to work. that's not always the best use of your time or whatever, but like, yeah, sometimes there's something there and it's just not working. Yeah. And other times there's nothing there. You just think there is.
Okay.
And who knows? It's hard to tell which is which sometimes, but I think like if you're all wrapped up in your head and you're just in your room and in your notebook, you need the audience to come into it, and you need a feedback loop at some point.